She's almost a celebrity in this city. And I'd not be at all surprised if she is behind the theft of the Mayan Codex. She thinks laws are local customs for the unintelligent and unimaginative. But like aristocrats everywhere, she doesn't do the unpleasant things herself. She hires people, like the imposters who took the Codex. It's highly unlikely that she would ever be charged with a crime here. She paused. Any crime. Really, said Remy. But she's a foreigner just like us. There's a difference. She paused. What I'm about to tell you is off the record. She's been here for years, making herself socially and financially useful to lots of powerful people. She's a huge landowner, and while you can't buy the old owner's social status with the land, obvious wealth is certainly a good way to get invitations. She's always contributed to the political campaigns of potential winners, and even more important, to the sure losers who are well-connected. She can accomplish a lot with a phone call, or even a hint dropped at a party. Sam said, "Can't we at least get the Guatemalan police to take a look at the estancia? Thousands of acres of plants in the fields and tons of buds in the drying barns are pretty hard to hide. And if they examined her operations, her offices, her houses, they couldn't help but find the Mayan Codex? Well, that's what we'd hope. But certainly evidence that she's been profiting from these drug operations." Amy Costa slowly shook her head. That would be too vast an undertaking. The authorities know that in the north and the west, the cartels have been operating in the big stretches of wilderness. The police would love to stop them. But what you're describing won't happen. If they found every single thing you saw, they still wouldn't arrest Sarah Allersby. Don't you see? She would be the prime victim. They could arrest 100 poor Mayan peasants who took jobs tending the crop. All the action, the dirty deals, the money-changing hands, took place in somebody's fancy house here in the capital. In Guatemala, if you're rich enough to own millions of acres in the countryside, you're too rich to live there. But you'll pass on the information to the police. Of course, she said. This isn't one crime. It's a war. We just keep on trying. What you've told me may turn out to be helpful, even important, sometime. It may put somebody away. Sam said, "Do you think we should go to the federal police, too?" "You can if you want. But maybe we can do it together. Are you free for an hour or so?" "Absolutely. Give me a minute to call ahead, and then we'll go." She dialed the number and spoke briefly in rapid Spanish. Then she buzzed the receptionist. "Please have a car for me. We'll leave as soon as it's ready." She explained to the Fargos. "It's in Zone 4. A bit too far to walk." They were driven to the federal police station on Avenida 311. The police officer at the door recognized Amy Costa and let them in. Costa walked up the hall to an elevator, which took them to an office. The uniformed officer, who stood as they entered, was young and clear-eyed. "This is Commander Rueda. This is Sam and Remy Fargo. They're two American visitors who saw some things you might wish to know about. Mr. Fargo?" Sam told the story, and Remy filled in details and supplied the GPS locations of the places described. Whenever the commander looked puzzled, Amy Costa translated the words into Spanish. At the end of the Fargo's recitation, the commander said, "Thank you very much for bringing this information to our attention. I will file a report conveying your experiences to the Central Command." He stood to terminate the visit. Sam remained seated. "Will anything happen? Will Sarah Allersby's properties be searched or her bank accounts audited?" The commander looked sympathetic. He sat down again. "I'm sorry, but those things will not happen. The armed gang was certainly one of the groups who patrol the north to protect the ranches where drugs are grown and shipped. Marijuana is a stable, reliable crop that can be grown in any remote area by anyone. But there's no proof of a connection with Sarah Allersby. Any piece of jungle, including national parkland, can be infiltrated by these criminals. We raid them and they turn up elsewhere. When we go away, they come back. Do they pay a landlord for the privilege? Sometimes, but not always. Your report of seeing coca trees, frankly, disturbs me most. We haven't had coca growing here. Until now, we've only been a stop on the route from South America. If you were to have a reason to search the Allersby houses, banks, and businesses for one thing and found another, could you still arrest her? Yes, provided we had a good legal reason to search. This time, we don't have a direct connection to her. He seemed to make a decision. I'm going to tell you something confidential. Like many rich and active business people, she has been investigated from time to time. In fact, it's happened twice that I know of in this office. We found nothing. Remy said, no money she couldn't explain? No Mayan artifacts? She calls herself a collector, and we saw plenty in her house. The commander said, if she has money she didn't declare here, it's no mystery. She has interests in many countries and a wealthy family. If there are Mayan artifacts, she could say they were part of the estate she bought from the Guerrero family, or some things her workers found recently that she would have reported. There's nothing criminal there, unless she did something definite and final. Sell them, or take them out of the country. What would you advise us to do? Asked Remy. What Miss Costa undoubtedly told you to do. Go home. If you want to, you could search the online markets for codices or parts of them. Often things are broken up and sold. If the codex turns up, we'll file charges and confiscate it. Thank you, said Remy. Sam shook the commander's hand. We appreciate your willingness to listen. Thank you for your evidence. And please, don't be discouraged. Justice is sometimes slow. Amy Costa had the embassy car drop them off at their hotel. Once they were in the room, they called Selma and asked her to get them a flight back to the United States. While they were waiting to hear from her, they went out to an English-language bookstore to buy books to read on the long flight home. Their itinerary included a stop in Houston, but the flying time was only 7 hours and 41 minutes. Sam slept through most of the flight to Houston while Remy read a book on the history of Guatemala. On the second flight, Remy slept while Sam read. When the plane lost altitude on its approach to the runway in San Diego, Remy's eyes opened. She said, I know what's wrong. We're missing our best ally in this. Who's that? Bartolomé de las Casas. Chapter 16. San Diego. Sam and Remy stepped out to the curb at the airport and found Selma waiting for them in the Volvo sedan. Zoltan was sitting sedately on the back seat of the car. Remy ducked into the back seat and sat beside Zoltan, who licked her face while she hugged and petted him.
Zoltan, he on your star.
What did you say? Selma asked. I said I missed him. I miss you too, but you aren't a Hungarian dog.
Likewise, I'm sure, said Selma.
Hi, Sam.
Hi, Selma. Thanks for coming to meet us.
It's a pleasure. Zoltan and I have been moping around the house since the robbery at the university. David King calls every day, but I told him you'd get in touch when you were home.
That reminds me. We won't be here long. We're going to Spain, said Sam. But first we want to meet with you and David. We can bring one another up to date on everything and then get busy on the next step.
All right. When we're home, I'll get going on your reservations, said Selma. It's a shame you're leaving. While you were in Guatemala, the workmen completed the painting and finish work. Your house is, well, your house again.
No carpenters, painters, or electricians left, said Remy.
Not one, Selma said.
I even had a cleaning crew in to be sure there's not a dimple of a bullet hole, a microscopic stain from a drop of blood, or a sliver of broken glass anywhere. Everything's new.
Thanks, Selma, said Remy. We're grateful.
Sam said, we'll try to keep it nice by not discharging firearms in the living room.
Remy said, Selma, I want you to spend some time with me before we meet with David Kane.
I need to know everything you've got about Bartolomé de las Casas and about the four known Mayan codices.
I'll be delighted, said Selma. I've been hoarding information on those topics since you were in Mexico.
6 hours later, they were on the ground floor of the house, sitting around the conference table. In the center was a photocopy of the letter from Bartolomé de las Casas. Sam said to David Kane, who had just arrived, I think Remy would like to start.
I just want to say thank you to Selma for having photographed the letter before turning it over to me, David interjected.
Remy began, By the time the Dresden Codex's existence became widely known, an Italian scholar had made a tracing of it. Before the Madrid Codex ever got to the Museo America de Madrid, a French abbot made a copy. The Paris Codex was copied by the same Italian scholar who traced the Dresden. Somebody at the Bibliothèque Nationale actually threw the original in a bin in a corner of a room, which damaged it, so it's a good thing there was a copy.
An interesting set of coincidences, said David Kane.
Where are you going with it?
Remy said, We know that this codex was at one point in the hands of Bartolomé de las Casas. This letter proves that he touched it, that he knew it was important and thought it must be saved.
Selma said, We know that he was a passionate defender of the native people's rights and a believer in the value of their cultures, and that he studied and spoke their languages.
David Kane slapped his hand to his forehead.
Of course. You're saying there's a chance that Las Casas might have made a copy.
We can't be sure, said Remy. But we think it's worth checking.
It's a long shot, said Kane.
As far as I know, there's no mention in any of his writings of his making a copy of a Mayan book. He does mention seeing the priests burning them.
That would be a good reason not to mention his copy, said Selma. Books weren't the only things getting burned in those days.
Remy said, After Las Casas left the mission at Rabanal, he became bishop of Chiapas, Mexico. From there he went back to the Spanish court, where he was a very powerful advisor on issues having to do with the Indians in the colonies. And here's the promising part. When he died in 1566, he left a very large library to the College of San Gregorio in Valladolid.
David Kane considered,
You know, I think your observation about human nature may be right. Everybody in Europe who saw the importance of the Mayan codices seems to have made a copy. Even I made photographic copies. It was practically the first thing I did. If only I hadn't given them up to those fake officials.
Selma quickly diverted the conversation back to Las Casas.
Then we're agreed. We know Las Casas saw it and was somebody who would have wanted a copy. If he made one, then it was almost certainly kept with his own books and papers rather than, say, submitted to the Spanish court.
His books and papers are in Valladolid, Spain. If the copy existed, and if it's been in a library in Spain all this time instead of the hot, humid Guatemalan jungle, then it will probably have survived.
David Kane said, That's a lot of ifs.
But to bolster the argument a bit, we know he would not have left any susceptible or incriminating papers in the New World, where his enemies, the Franciscans or the Encomiendas, could find them. He definitely would have taken them with him to Spain.
Remy said, A lot of ifs, all right. But each one has a lot of arguments in its favor, and not many against.
Let's call it an educated long-shot guess, Selma said. It really should be checked.
Sam said, Okay, Selma. Please make arrangements to get Remy and me to Valladolid. Make us a copy of the letter so we can recognize his handwriting if we see it.
Sarah Allersby sat in the giant office of the Empresa Guerrero in the old part of Guatemala City. It had once been the business office in the capital of the powerful and wealthy Guerrero family. They had occupied the building from colonial days, until the modern civil war bled many of its businesses and made the younger generation leave for lives of leisure in Europe. The office was near the Palacio Nacional because the big ranching families, of necessity, had been involved in the government. Through all of the 19th and most of the 20th centuries, a man in the Guerrero family would push out his chair from the big mahogany desk in the office, take his hat and cane from the rack near the door, light a cigar, and walk up the street to government headquarters to protect and further the interests of the Guerrero family companies. The building had an impressive but low Baroque facade, a set of double doors that were so heavy that Sarah Allersby had to have an electric motor installed to help her push them open, and floors of antique tiles made and decorated by the same craftsman who had done the Iglesia de la Merced. The ceilings were 15 feet high, and every few feet a big lazy fan still provided the proper subtropical atmosphere, even though the air it circulated was air-conditioned to 72 degrees. Sarah used a 1930s-era desk telephone with a scrambled line that was checked by her security people twice each day to detect a change in ohms of resistance that would indicate a listening device. She said, "Good morning, Russell. This line is safe, so you can speak freely." The man on the other end had a contract with the Estancia Guerrero, but Sarah's family had used his services many times in the years before they had acquired the Guatemalan holdings. He was the man who had impersonated an FBI agent in San Diego. "What can I do for you, Miss Allersby?"
"It's more trouble over the item we picked up in San Diego. Sam and Remy Fargo had been here in Guatemala, and even managed to find their way onto the Estancia. They've been defaming me and my company to anyone who will listen. They seem to think that the marijuana operation on the Estancia is mine, as though I was some tawdry drug dealer. They wanted the police to search my house and all of my properties, if you can imagine."
"Is there any chance the police will do that?"
"Of course not," she said. "But I can't simply ignore them. They left for the United States yesterday. I know they won't get anywhere with the authorities here, but I have no way of knowing what they can do there. I need to have them watched for a while."
"Certainly," he said. "There are two ways to go about this kind of thing. We can simply hire some local San Diego private detectives. That would mean leaving a record that we had hired them and taking the risk that they might have to reveal who hired them in court sometime. Then there's..."
"The other way, please," she said. "What we've already done in San Diego could generate terrible legal problems, and I worry about this Sam Fargo. He's vindictive. He won't be able to let this go. And if he wanted to, his wife wouldn't let him. I think she's developed a jealous fear that I'm a threat to her marriage. She's got nothing going for her but her looks, and as soon as somebody prettier is around, she knows she's in trouble."
"All right," Russell said. "The Fargos haven't seen me. I can do this myself with one good man. We can be in San Diego in a couple of hours."
"Thank you, Russell. I'll have some money sent to your company to cover the initial expenses."
"Thank you.
Just knowing you're personally paying attention to the problem will make me sleep better. I'm just one person, and I can't be expected to pay attention to everybody everywhere who wants to harm me."
"Would you like to set a limit on how expensive this gets?"
"No. If they leave the United States, send people wherever they go. I want to know where they are. And I never want them suddenly showing up on my doorstep again. But I don't want to leave a record that I had them followed. I really can't have them ruining my reputation."
Russell was already preparing for the trip while he listened. He took a suitcase out of his closet and set it on the bed. "I'll let you know as soon as there's anything to report."
"Thank you, Russell."
Next, Russell called the number of Jerry Ruiz, the man who had impersonated the Mexican Minister of Culture when they had confiscated the Codex.
"Hi, Jerry. This is Russ. I'd like you with me on a surveillance job."
"Where?"
"It's back in San Diego, but it could go anywhere from there. We're to keep track of a couple, period. We can split what Sarah gives us, even."
"It's for her." "Okay. I'm in."
"I'll pick you up in a half hour."
Russell hung up and returned to his suitcase. He packed the sets of clothes he used for surveillance, black jeans and navy blue nylon windbreaker and black sneakers, baseball caps in several colors, some olive drab hiking pants that unzipped into shorts, a couple of sport coats in navy and gray, some khaki pants. He and Ruiz would fly down and rent a car, and after a couple of days he would turn it in and get another one. He had found over the years that even a minor change in his appearance had a dramatic effect. Just putting on a hat and a different jacket made him a new person. Alternating drivers, getting out of the car and sitting at a restaurant table, made him invisible. He completed his packing by throwing in some equipment. A shooter's 60-power spotting scope with a small tripod, and his personal weapons and some ammunition. He knew that Ruiz would come prepared. Ruiz habitually carried a pistol, even in Los Angeles, and had a boot knife, because that was the way he had come up. He had been a collector for a street gang as a teenager, and then he became a cop for a while. It was a strange twist that as he'd come into middle age, he had begun to look like a Mexican politician or a judge. His appearance made him a good man for the job. He wasn't automatically a suspect. He was also fluent in Spanish, and that helped many times. When Russell took this kind of job, he liked to have more time to prepare. But he would manage. He threw in his passport, $5,000 in cash, and a laptop computer. He closed his suitcase and went out to his car. He locked the house, then stopped for a second to be sure he'd forgotten nothing essential. Then he got into the car and drove toward Ruiz's house, thinking about the job. Sarah Allersby was on the verge of taking a big step toward learning who she was. That was the way he thought about it. He had worked for many bosses over the years, and he had seen the way they learned. They started out with the proposition that they were better than other people, and therefore had a responsibility to lead them. In exchange for that brave work, they gained most of the available wealth. Once they had the wealth, it was theirs, and they had a right to protect it and the privileges it bought. If that was true, then they also had a right to get more in the same way, or really in any way, including taking it. They got involved in businesses that killed people indirectly, where they didn't have to see it. Diego San Martin, the drug lord who paid Sarah for the security of being able to raise marijuana on the land of a rich, respectable woman, had killed people. He was probably killing people all the time. Little by little, she was getting used to the idea that it didn't matter. Russell had met Sarah's father after Mr. Allersby had already reached that point. Russell's first job for the older Allersby was to kill a man, a business rival who was preparing to file a patent infringement suit. Russell knew, although Sarah hadn't taken the step yet, that she was very nearly ready to buy the deaths of these Fargo people. That could happen at any time. It occurred to him that he had better stop at the office and pick up a couple of additional items. He drove to the back of the building and went up the exterior stairway, unlocked the door, and turned on the light. He went to a locked filing cabinet and opened it. He took a pair of razor-sharp ceramic knives, which wouldn't set off metal detectors, and a diabetic's travel kit, with needles and insulin bottles in a leather case. The insulin in the bottles had been replaced with Anectine, a drug that surgeons use to stop the heart. They would restart it with adrenaline, but of course, restarting hearts wasn't the business Russell was in, so he had none of that. He opened the leather case and looked at the prescription date. It was the new one,
only a month old. He took the kit with him and put it in his suitcase. As Russell drove on toward Ruiz's house, he felt better. When Sarah got around to recognizing what she really wanted done, Russell and Ruiz would be able to take care of it without uncertainty or delay. Upper-class customers like her hated uncertainty, and they hated waiting. They wanted to be able to signify their will and have it carried out right away, like gods. Chapter 17. San Diego to Spain. Remy and Sam boarded their plane out of San Diego 2 days later. The flight took them to New York JFK, where they had to wait for their next plane to leave for Madrid in the late evening. The flight brought them into Madrid Barajas Airport early in the morning. When they had been hiking in Guatemala, they had tried to look like eco-tourists or history buffs, so they'd brought only well-worn tropical clothes, which they had rolled up and carried in their backpacks. This time they were traveling as a pair of rich American tourists who couldn't possibly be doing anything serious. They had bought new matching luggage that looked as expensive as it was. Each piece had an embossed leather tag sewn on that said Fargo, and one was packed with the Brioni suits Sam had bought a few months ago in Rome, the other with some of Remy's fashionable dresses, shoes, and jewelry. Remy brought a Fendi perforated leather sleeveless dress with a nude silk lining she'd been saving, a Dolce & Gabbana floral print dress, and a short J. Mendel silk crew neck dress that had made Sam watch her walk all the way across the room when she'd tried it on. Also inside their bags were small digital spy cameras, two embedded in watches and two in clear eyeglasses. They knew that if the copy of the Codex existed, they would not be able to remove it from the building, and getting permission to photograph it would be at least difficult and maybe impossible. Even worse, just asking permission would announce to the rest of the world that the copy existed and would soon reveal what it contained. They flew first class on the transatlantic flight, and when they arrived, they took a taxi to the Chamartín station and boarded the streamlined Alta Velocidad Española bullet train to Valladolid. The train took only 1 hour and 10 minutes to cover 130 miles, including passing through a 17-mile tunnel. Selma had made a reservation for them at the Zenit Imperial Hotel, a 15th-century palace next to the town hall on the Plaza Mayor. She also downloaded a digital version of a guidebook to Valladolid on Remy's iPad. Sam and Remy spent their first day exploring the city, validating their appearance as rich tourists who had time to spare. The modern city of Valladolid is a manufacturing and communications center and a major grain market, but they entertained themselves by seeking out the old city, where the remnants of the Middle Ages still stood. Remy read from a guidebook as they walked from place to place. The Spanish conquered the city from the Moors in the 10th century. Unfortunately, they forgot to ask the Moors what Valladolid meant, so we don't know.
Thanks for that, said Sam. Anything else on the list of missing facts?
Scads. But we do know Valladolid was the chief residence of the kings of Castile. Ferdinand and Isabella were married here, and Columbus died here. Cervantes wrote part of Don Quixote here.
I'm impressed, said Sam. And I'm serious.
Their last stop was the Colegio de San Gregorio, where Las Casas lived for several years after he returned from the New World. They walked to the front of the great stone building as Remy checked her guidebook. The portal to the chapel, the building in front of us, was built by Alonso de Burgos, confessor to Queen Isabella in 1488. The chapel itself was finished in 1490. She looked down at the stones of the pavement.
So right now, we're standing where Columbus, Queen Isabella, and Ferdinand probably stood.
Not to mention Bartolomé de las Casas, Sam said quietly. It's really an amazing piece of architecture.
Las Casas came here to live in 1551. He rented a cell in the college. During this period, he was very influential at Emperor Charles V's court. He died in 1566 in Madrid, but left his extensive library to the college. Our next mission is to see if we can find it. On the other side of the street, there was a gaggle of German tourists being led by a tall, blonde woman who was lecturing them on the sights. In the center of the group were the two men who had followed Sam and Remy to Spain, Russell and Ruiz. When Sam and Remy stepped into the entrance, Russell and Ruiz separated themselves from the German tourists and moved down the street to watch the chapel from a distance. Sam and Remy walked through the entrance and into the chapel. It was a dream of white stone, carved and polished 500 years ago and still the same in the echoing silence as though time had only passed by outside, not in here. "The upper tier must be where Las Casas rented his room," said Sam, "and where he wrote his last few books." They walked through the college while Remy scanned the guidebook. "Life wasn't all pretty here," she said. "In 1559, the Inquisition burned 27 people at the stake in Valladolid, and at one point, an enemy denounced Las Casas to the Inquisitors too, but the accusation didn't go anywhere. When Las Casas signed over the rights to his History of the Indies to the college, he added the condition that it not be published until 40 years passed. He said that if God destroyed Spain for its sins, he wanted people in the future to know what exactly they had done wrong. They had treated the Indians with such cruelty. Let's keep looking. If we find his library, maybe we can make an appointment to get in and take a look at it tomorrow," said Sam. They continued to search and eventually found their way to a museum of Spanish sculpture. They approached the man at the desk near the entrance. "Here goes," Remy whispered. Remy said to him in Spanish, "Sir, do you know where we should go to see the library that Bishop Bartolomé de las Casas donated to the College of San Gregorio?" "Yes, I do," replied the man. "First, you must know that it's all part of the University of Valladolid." "I suppose the books had to be moved to a modern university." The man smiled. "The university was founded in 1346, but yes, it's modern. It's an active institution with 31,000 students. The College of San Gregorio is a part of it, but serves mainly as a museum of art and architecture now. The monks are gone. I believe what you're looking for is quite close by in the history library."
"How do we find the history library?"
"Go down the Calle Gandomar to the main university. Outside is the patio. There are three levels set on octagonal pillars. On the right side is the chapel, and on the left is a semicircular porch. Go left. The first level houses the history library." As they walked to the library, Sam noticed that two men were on the same course, walking far behind them on Calle Gandomar. He wondered for a moment if they could be following him and Remy. He and Remy had, after all, put Sarah Allersby on notice that they weren't going to let her rob them and forget it. But they were a long way from Guatemala City, and they'd just arrived in Valladolid. Could these men have followed them here already? They would have had to be watching them in San Diego practically from the time they'd come home from Guatemala, then caught the same plane or the one after it. They reached the history library, and Remy asked in Spanish whether they could see the collection of books that Bartolomé de las Casas had left the College of San Gregorio. They were pleasantly surprised to learn that they could sign in as visiting scholars, and a librarian would admit them without too many intimidating formalities. They only had to prove their identities and leave Remy's purse and their passports at the desk. When they entered a large reading room, there were already a few graduate students reading old books at tables. A second history librarian showed them to a rare book room, gave them gloves, and allowed them to examine the volumes in de las Casas' collection for about 3 hours, going from one volume to the next. All of the volumes were bound or rebound in old leather. Some were hand-copied Latin or Spanish in archaic handwriting. Some were in incunabula, works printed before 1500, a few in medieval Gothic script with hand-painted illumination. Most were religious works in Latin. There were commentaries on the Bible, collected sermons, multiple copies of breviaries. There was a copy of the Corpus Aristotelicum. There were also Spanish volumes written or copied in a hand that was clearly the same as the writing on the letter that had been hidden in the Mayan codex. Whenever they saw one, it excited them. But none was what they had come so far to find. The treasure they searched for would consist of Mayan pictures and glyphs, not Spanish text. At the end of the day, just before it was time for visitors to leave the library, the desk librarian made an announcement that readers should return books. The Fargos gave theirs up immediately, went to the desk to retrieve Remy's bag, and left. As they emerged onto the patio outside the building, Remy whispered, "Have you seen those two men before?" Sam stopped, apparently to look around him at the medieval Spanish architecture, but took a moment to find the men she meant. They were already walking off in another direction. "I saw a couple of men earlier on the Calle Gondomar, but I can't tell if those are the same ones. What did they do?"
"I could feel them staring at us."
Sam smiled. "You could feel them staring at you, more likely. You should be used to that." That evening, Sam and Remy began their exploration of the city's nightlife with the Plaza Mayor, right outside their hotel. They sampled the coffee in the Continental, then went for pinchos, the favorite local iteration of tapas, at Restaurante Los Sagales. They were made of morcilla sausages, red onion, and pork rind, all wrapped into a roll. Each day, Sam and Remy walked from the Zenith Imperial Hotel and returned to the History Library to examine the next group of 500-year-old books. After the library closed that afternoon, Sam and Remy returned to their hotel for a nap, then got up at 10 to begin their evening of exploring. That night they tried Taberna Pradera, known for the fresh calamari cracker in its own ink. The following night they tried Fortuna 25, which served a free-range chicken stuffed with mussels and algae. Another night it was Taberna del Surdo. They drank Rueda, Ribera del Duero, and other fine Spanish red wines, moving from place to place as though each evening were a celebration. During the days they pressed on with the Las Casas collection, making their inventory and, in the process, getting to know a little about the man who had owned these books. Most of them were books like The Rule of Saint Benedict, the work that set the tone for the monastic life, the Moralium Libri of Pope Gregory I, and others that were appropriate for a monk in the 16th century. They found several copies of the works of Thomas Aquinas, and a handwritten volume of commentary on them. It was on their eighth day in the library that Sam and Remy ran into another trove of volumes in Spanish that had been written on vellum in the hand of Bartolomé de las Casas. They were tall, in a ledger format, all in a sequence. The first were his attempts, written in Mexico, at collecting a Quiche language glossary. There were also observations on the other languages of the Mayans, written in 1536. The next volume was a journal recording the daily activities that had gone on at the Dominican missions he had founded at Rabanal, Zacapulas, and Coban. Records of expenditures and harvests were interspersed with various notes on the building of churches in the region and the names of Mayan converts who had come to live outside Rabanal. Remy read that he was opposed to mass conversions of Indians. He believed in teaching each prospective Catholic and then letting him or her make an informed decision, so the inventory of converts made sense. The date of the volume after that was October 1536, and it extended through April 1537. It began with the now familiar columns of figures and notations on vellum that had been divided into columns by straight lines. It went on for many pages, and then, at a certain point, the quality of the vellum changed. The first pages were routine quality, made from the skin of an animal, treated by removing the hair, wetting, stretching, and drying the skin until it was a thin white surface for writing on both sides. But sewn in after 50 or 60 sheets was a long section of pages of a different quality vellum. These had been rubbed so thoroughly with pumice stone or a similar abrasive to make a perfectly smooth writing surface that they were translucent. Sam turned the first page in this section and saw a startling sight. It was an exact copy of the letter from Las Casas that had been hidden in the binding of the Mayan Codex. He touched Remy's arm, and they both stared at the familiar Spanish words. A todos mis compatriotas, bendiciones. Este libro y otros de los Maya se refieren a su historia y sus observaciones acerca del mundo natural. No tienen nada que ver con el diablo. Ellos deben ser preservados como una manera de entender nuestras tareas con los Maya.
I can make out most of the words, and can hardly believe it, said Sam.
I can hardly breathe, said Remy. I'm afraid to turn the page.
Sam reached down and carefully turned the page. What appeared was the opening page of the Mayan Codex they had found on the Mexican volcano. They turned page after page, slowly, gently. Each time the vellum turned, there was a familiar display. The four-page map was there in all its complexity. The illustrated story of the creation of the universe was there. The story of the war between the cities was there. Each small glyph was drawn with a fine-cut quill pen, its intricacies reproduced exactly.
Sam stood up.
Excuse me. He went to the men's room, made sure it was empty, took out his satellite phone, and called Selma in San Diego. Selma?
Yes.
We've found it. Turn everything on and prepare to receive live video starting in 15 seconds. We won't be able to speak to you until it's over.
Got it. Making the connection to all four cameras now.
Gotta go. Sam returned from the men's room and whispered to Remy, Your eyes must be getting strained. Don't be vain. Put on your glasses. Remy and Sam put on the two cameras disguised as glasses and went back to the first page. As they turned pages, Sam and Remy were sending digital video with the camera glasses. They could see that the copy Las Casas had made was done with extreme care. He had not made an attempt to reproduce the colors of the original, but everything else was the same. The pages had been scored with a straight edge to divide the space into columns, usually six, but sometimes eight, as the original had been. The pages had not been given Arabic folio numbers, but Sam and Remy could tell from memory that at least the beginning 30 pages seemed to be in order. Selma's voice came through the tiny earphones embedded in the stems of their eyeglasses.
I'm receiving everything clearly. Keep going.
Sam and Remy kept turning pages and filming until they reached the 136th and final page. Then they started over again at the end of the section and took still photographs of each spread of open pages, using the cameras in their wristwatches. When they had finished, Sam folded his glasses and put them into his jacket pocket.
I'm getting tired. Let's go back to our hotel.
They returned the volume to the librarian for reshelving and then retrieved Remy's purse and the briefcase Sam had brought. They thanked the librarian and left the building. As they went down the steps in the late afternoon and turned to walk along the street toward their hotel, Sam reminded Remy, No matter what happens in the next few minutes, don't be startled, and hold on to your glasses and wristwatch. As they walked along the Calle de las Cadenas de San Gregorio to the Plaza Mayor, they were only two tourists in a large open space with hundreds of people. When they were about halfway across the plaza, they heard a new sound, the deep, throaty sound of a motorcycle engine. The engine grew louder as the motorcycle came around a corner somewhere behind them. Remy started to turn to look over her shoulder, but Sam put his arm around her and whispered, Don't look, or you'll scare them off. The motorcycle sped up directly behind them, and Sam turned suddenly. On the cycle were a driver and a man riding behind him. Both men were wearing helmets with tinted visors over their faces. As the motorcycle swooped in, the driver made an attempt to snatch Sam's briefcase out of his hand, but Sam held on to it, tugging back as the driver pulled. The power of the cycle added to the driver's force, but Sam trotted alongside, still holding on. When the second man saw the way Sam held on, he joined the struggle, grasped the briefcase with both hands, and wrenched it away. The driver gunned the engine and accelerated, and the motorcycle roared off around the side of the plaza, turned, and disappeared up a narrow street between tall buildings. Sam held up his empty hand so Remy could see it.
Sam, he stole your new briefcase.
He smiled. A little engineering project.
What are you talking about? Those men stole your briefcase. We've got to call the police.
No need, he said. Those are the two we noticed about a week ago outside San Gregorio. I saw them watching us a few times since then. They were too interested to be nobody. So I bought the briefcase and began my project.
Your briefcase is an engineering project?
Didn't I say that?
Stop being mysterious and tell me what you've done.
You know those booby-trapped bags of money that banks give to bank robbers?
The ones that blow up and cover the thief with indelible ink?
Oh, no.
How did you even get an explosive on the plane?
I didn't use explosives. This one works with springs. Undo the latch, and the first spring pops the case open wide, and that allows the second to spring upward and push a piston, like a jack-in-the-box. The cylinder is full of ink. I bought the briefcase, the springs, and the ink here.
But what would have happened if the librarian had inspected it?
He didn't open anything for the first 2 days, so why do it later?
What would have happened to him?
He would have a bright blue face. Azul, as they say here.
You couldn't just watch these men and not play some dumb prank?
I did watch them. I noticed they spoke English to each other, and one of them spoke Spanish to everybody else. Rapid, fluent Spanish that didn't leave anybody looking confused. I thought about who would spend several days watching us like that without doing anything. The only answer is that Sarah Allersby must have sent them.
Why would she do that? She has the codex. She doesn't need a copy.
To find out what we're doing and what we've accomplished.
And?
And now she knows. Once her men followed us to Valladolid, I'm sure she could figure out what else might be here. All I could do is make sure we know them if we see them again in the next few days. They walked quickly to their hotel, downloaded the photographs from the digital cameras to Remy's laptop computer, and then sent two versions to Selma's computer in San Diego as a backup. While Remy waited for the transfers to be completed, she made a reservation to fly to San Diego on the red-eye, leaving in 4 hours.
As she and Sam finished packing, Remy's phone rang. She said, "Hi, Selma. Are the pictures all clear?"
"Good.
We're coming home."
There was a pause. Then she said, "Because a couple of men stole Sam's briefcase. When they open it, they're going to want to kill us. If they don't succeed, we'll see you tomorrow night."
Chapter 18. Valladolid, Spain. Russell was in the bathroom of the hotel suite in Valladolid, dabbing at his blue face with a cotton ball soaked in acetone. The thick nail polish remover smell stung his sinuses. Added to the smell of the isopropyl alcohol and the turpentine he had tried first, it made the small enclosed space unbearable. He looked in the mirror above the sink.
"This isn't working either, and it stinks."
"Maybe if you rub a little harder," said Ruiz.
He could see through the blue dye on Russell's face that his chin was getting blotchy and irritated, but Ruiz didn't feel like going out again searching Valladolid for more chemicals and solvents. Russell handed him the bottle and then used soap and water to wash the acetone off his face.
"Get something else."
Ruiz said, "This stuff almost always works. We used it to wash checks years ago. It would take off the ink in a couple minutes."
"We're not washing checks now," said Russell. "This is my face."
"But you gave me an idea."
"Remember, there was a secret to washing checks. If the dye in the ink was polar,
The best thing to get it off was a polar solvent like alcohol and acetone.
Well, we've tried those, so let's try a non-polar solvent like toluene.
Toluene, said Ruiz. What's another name for it?
Methylbenzene.
Where do I go for that?
A paint store. The kind for artists might have it.
You go in and ask for paint thinners. Get every kind they have. Try that first. If you pass by a dry cleaner, try them too. Say you spilled ink on a couch and you'll pay for some of the stuff they use for ink stains.
I'm getting hungry, said Ruiz.
Buy something to eat on the way, then. I can't go out like this and shop for thinners, and the smells are making me sick, so I couldn't eat anyway. Just get me something that will take the ink off. We've got to fix this now.
Ruiz picked up his jacket off the chair and went down the hall to the narrow, cage-like elevator. When Russell heard the elevator's grating slide to the side to admit Ruiz, he rinsed his face again and looked in the mirror. His face felt hot, that if the blue were removed, it would be glowing. The trap had sprung when he had unlatched the briefcase. One spring mechanism had snapped the briefcase open, and the other had pushed the circular bottom of an ink-filled cylinder upward like a piston. It had been sealed at the top with only a layer of wax paper. Ink had shot out onto his face and chest.
Fiendish. What kind of person thought that way?
The trap had required that Fargo figure out in advance that somebody was going to take his briefcase. Russell was sure he hadn't been spotted. Had Ruiz made some stupid mistake? Or did Fargo always walk around in foreign cities carrying a booby trap? Russell rubbed some cold cream all over his face and neck, desperate to soothe his burning skin. He dialed his satellite phone.
Hello,
said Sarah Allersby. It's me, he said. We went to San Diego and then followed them to the airport. They flew to Spain. That's where I'm calling from, Valladolid.
What are they doing there?
We've been watching them for a few days. At first, all they did was go sightseeing in the daytime and out to expensive restaurants every night.
By now, they must have hit nearly all of them, Sarah Allersby said.
Pretty near. For 8 days, they've been going to the University of Valladolid every day. They seem to be really interested in all the old buildings in town. But they've been doing some sort of research.
I'm starting to feel uncomfortable.
Reassure me. What are they researching? They go to the history library and look at old books. Everywhere she goes, she has a big leather purse. After a couple of days, he started carrying a briefcase. They had to leave them with the librarian when they got there and pick them up when they left.
What was in the cases?
I figured they might be pulling a scam. The people who go to these old libraries to steal things like valuable prints or maps or illuminated pages all do it pretty much the same way. They go into a rare book room and read the books. They bring in a razor blade, hide it in one hand, and when nobody's looking, run it down a page to cut it loose. Then they slip the page under their clothes. I couldn't watch them much, so I never saw them do anything.
You're getting me very nervous about this. Did you find out what books they looked at?
Ruiz went in once right after they left and took a look. The binding on the book said Las Casas. That means the houses, right?
She sighed deeply, trying to use up a few seconds to avoid calling him an imbecile. She said calmly, "It's the name of the Dominican friar who colonized the Alta Verapaz area of Guatemala. He was active around the time when the Mayan Codex was buried by the landslide. I'm not sure what they could have thought they were accomplishing by reading about him."
I decided today that I was going to find out exactly what they'd been up to. Ruiz and I got on a motorcycle, and while they were walking in the plaza, we went by them fast. I snatched the briefcase out of Fargo's hand. It's a kind of robbery that happens all the time in Spain and Italy. Before the mark knows what happened, the bike is gone.
Were there pages inside the briefcase?
No.
What do the notes say?
I'm sure you read his notes.
There were none. The briefcase was a booby trap. As soon as I clicked the clasp, a spring mechanism popped the case wide open, and another spring pushed a piston up a cylinder full of blue ink. It's all over my face.
Oh my gosh, she said. So he saw you watching them.
I don't think that's a fair assumption, Russell said. The briefcase might have been only a precaution.
Then he knows about you now, doesn't he?
He only knows that he got robbed. He can't know why. They've been walking around here at night for over a week, wearing expensive clothes, staying in a fancy hotel, eating in exclusive restaurants. That attracts thieves.
I can't believe this,
Sarah muttered. It sounded to Russell as though she was talking to herself.
These people will not go away and leave me alone. They keep pushing and pushing me. Did I tell you they denounced me to the Guatemala Federal Police? Well, they did. They're absolutely relentless, like ants. If you block one way in, they'll find another. They're persecuting me. I offered them a fair price. They're the ones who turned me down.
I'm sorry we didn't stop them in San Diego. Or here, at least. Sarah was feeling more and more sorry for herself.
Have you gotten cleaned up from the ink yet?
Not yet, he said. We've tried several solvents, but so far no luck. I just sent Ruiz out for more.
Russell, I need somebody to rid me of these people. They've become vicious now, and dangerous, not only to my reputation and my business, but even to you. That ink trap could just as easily have been acid or an explosive.
I'm sure he meant me to understand that. Any non-fatal attack is a warning.
We can't go on this way, she said. If someone threatens your life, you're justified in using any force to save yourself.
I'm not sure the authorities here would see it that way, he said. She was assuming he'd just kill the Fargos for free. He had been planning to offer that option for a high price.
She said, it doesn't matter what the authorities want. There's such a thing as natural rights.
I'm afraid that if you decided on an aggressive defense, I would have to charge an additional fee, he said. I have to pay Ruiz and so on. He waited for an answer. When it came, she sounded distracted, distant.
Oh, yes. I was thinking of you as an equal. But of course I had no right to do that. You're someone who works for me and has to think about money. How does an extra 5,000 sound?
I was thinking it would have to be 10, he said. Oh, Russell, I'd hate to think you called to get me all upset about what they'd done to you so you could take advantage of my sympathy to raise your prices. No, Miss Allersby, he said. I'd never do that. The figure is the minimum I'd actually need. I'll have to get my color back so I don't stand out. Buy weapons for one-time use in a European country where they're heavily controlled. Pay to dispose of the bodies. Find a quiet way out of Spain and back to the U.S. and compensate Ruiz.
All right, then. 10.
Thank you, he said.
But you have to do it, not just promise it and take the money in advance.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. I haven't gotten rid of my blue face yet.
You may not know this, but cosmetic companies sell opaque makeup that's designed to cover scars, birthmarks, and discolorations. If the blue doesn't wash off, you can cover it up until your skin recovers on its own.
Thanks. I'll keep that in mind.
Do. When those horrible Fargo people disappear from my life, I'll make you glad they did.
He heard the click as she hung up. Sarah sat in the big office in the old quarter of Guatemala City.
Why was her patience being so sorely tested? These little people, these nothings, were making her life unbearable.
Since they had left Guatemala,
Diego San Martin had come to her home to tell her that the Fargos had killed several members of one of his security patrols before they had slipped away into the jungle. An enraged drug lord was not a pleasant guest. He had labor issues, too. If men who worked for him were killed,